Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 20th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Jan Keeson. Today's session number is KEJ2001-01 and it's titled Betty Crocker in the Jungle. Let's listen in.
I teach lit at Augustana College and I've grown up in Illinois. So I lived most of my life in the Midwest. And when I went to school at the University of Chicago, my dream was once I got that degree, I could pick where I wanted to go and I could go out west and live in a community like this and live happily ever after teaching. Somehow, you know, when Augie had the ad, they had an ad on the job board, and I thought, what kind of a crummy little school would put an ad in a bib card job board rather than advertise in our magazine the way they were supposed to? And I thought, well, I'll try out just to practice on them. And I absolutely fell in love with Tweet, you know, and the people there were very, very good to me. And so I wound up in the Midwest. I found out that, come on in, sit down, that the few jobs that I qualified for that were open in the West also had some problems in terms of funding and, you know, how long I could stay. I might be able to stay only a year or so. But anyway, my dream was to be in a place like this, and I wound up in the Midwest. But the consolation was I just happened to fall into a log cabin made of ponderosa pines from Montana. So. I'll put that rack outside. But anyway, why don't we close the door? We have an hour, and what I would like to do is to begin, since the rubric here is talk about the best book I ever read. And that's basically what we're going to be talking about all week long. And I've chosen some books, not because they're necessarily the best book, but to generate discussion on your part and see what's, you know, what makes the best book. So the first question that I have for you is, what's the best book you ever read? And I know what some of you are going to say. It's not really a great book, but... So let's hear it.
It's the one I'm reading right now.
Okay.
Berg's book on a biography on Charles Lindbergh.
Lindbergh. All right. I'm going to write these down.
That's a good Lutheran name, I think.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so you have Lindbergh. And what, tell us, John, what do you really love about this book? Why is it such a great book?
It's about 600, well, yeah, two things. I'm a private pilot. It's about flying.
And, okay.
But also, it deals with international relations and... Lindbergh was a very complex and very stubborn person, and so from a psychological point of view, it's also very interesting.
Okay.
It deals with history of particularly the Second World War.
Okay. So anyway, what you're saying is the topic is engaging, and there's some kind of rapport that you have with this, you can invest in it.
Right.
All right.
Right.
Okay. Who else has, what's the best book you're reading or you've ever read? Talk to us. If nothing else, we're going to develop a reading list here. It always works because whenever I hear these books, I think, oh, I've got to read this book now. Tell me your name and what you love to read.
My name's Dawn, and I read a book about 12 years ago that I loved, and I've reread it a couple times. It's called Woods Woman by Anne LaBastille.
Woods Woman.
Yeah.
Okay. Tell us about it.
Well, it's about this lady. It's kind of thorough in the way, but it's a woman. She goes out and builds a cabin and just simplifies her life and gets rid of all her worldly possessions and goes out and builds a cabin and lives out there with her German Shepherd.
Okay. Happily ever after.
Yeah. At least for 4 years that she wrote the book.
Okay. And so why do you like this book?
Well, I guess, you know, it's kind of a romantic idea of actually doing it. You know,
okay.
It's something I would never really do, but I like the idea of it.
It's all right.
Yeah, it's a true story. Yeah.
Okay, and John said before it was something he just, he could relate to. So that's one of the criteria that you're using for what makes a book that at least compels you, or interests you.
Right.
All right. On that same vein, there's a book I was just talking to Faye Clough, who is my buddy here this, for the 10 days or a couple weeks I'm staying. And we were hiking today to Heart Lake, this supposedly moderate hike that and I'm glad to hear that you're laughing. Because believe me, we weren't by the time we were coming trudging back here. But fortunately, we recovered for tonight. But I said, there's this book, something like you had recommended, called Crusoe of Lonesome Lake. If any of you like that kind of reading. And this was recommended to me by a fellow I know in Wyoming. He says, you've got to read that book. It's the best book I ever read. And it talks about this fellow who carved out a place for himself in Lonesome Lake, way up in Alaska, and the different obstacles that he had, and what he did. He finally found a wife, and they had children, what they did. And one of the things that just is so unusual about this guy was that he finally built his own airplane. So Jan, you've got to read this. And I mean, he sent for the blueprints and the designs, and he built his airplane because he was having some difficulty with transportation, as you may imagine. All right. Any other? What's the best book? Let's hear it.
The Red Tent.
All right. The Red Tent. Tell us about it.
It's the story of Dina, Jacob's only daughter.
Okay, keep talking, because I don't know this one.
Oh, well, it's the story of the 12 tribes told from the woman's point of view.
Oh, really?
So it's a considerably different story. And the sisterhood of the women.
Interesting. Well, we'll touch a little bit on that today with King Salver, with the names. And maybe you can tell us about Rachel and some of the names that we're going to come up with. Okay, so what is it that you like about the Red Tent in these women's stories?
I liked that feeling of community that the
okay.
women had.
And again, it's something you can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anybody else?
Catherine Graham's book, and I read it before she died with all the publicity, but it was wonderful, my personal history.
Okay.
And I can relate because I lived through that era, but her friends were not exactly my friends, and so it was fun to hear about Warren Buffett.
She was an interesting character, wasn't she?
She
does everybody know who Catherine Graham is? All right.
Yeah, and it was, I loved her women's viewpoint as she came along because she was thrown into the leadership of the paper. It was her family paper. And she thought the men weren't paying any attention to her because she didn't know anything about the business, which was true.
Yep.
But Gloria Steinem got a hold of her and sort of revealed to her the truth that they didn't want to be bossed around by a woman. So anyway, lots of interesting stories.
Okay, well, that sounds like a good one to read. I'll put on my list, too. Faye, I hope you're taking notes.
Yeah, I am.
Do you have a handout here? Do you have those handouts?
I laid them on the...
Oh, they're here. While we're talking, since we only have an hour, I'm going to hand these out to you. But what I would like to ask for those of you who are for sure coming back, you can keep them. I have just 10 here, so you're going to have to share them. And for those of you who aren't going to come back, please send them back because you're going to have two... You know, I'm going to have what I'm going to talk about tomorrow in this handout, too. So, you know, I've got to have those back one way or the other, please. All right. Any more really great books that you want to talk about? Yeah.
The Sparrow.
The Sparrow.
Mary Joy Russell.
Russell Sparrow. Okay. Tell us about it.
It's an exploration of faith, but it's told from... a futuristic point of view, and she has people on Earth hearing what they interpret as music, singing coming from another planet, and so they believe that there are sentient and also probably compassion or human-like characters there, but when they travel, and it's Jesuits that go because it's interesting that way.
Yeah, okay.
And when they go, they find out that there's some very, that the culture is completely different than they had imagined. And it sort of shatters, in some ways, their notions of faith and expectation.
Okay. All right, so we have most of the things that you're telling me is what makes a great book for you is something that you can relate to personally, either spiritually or psychically or whatever else. So let me tell you a little bit about, just briefly, about the history that we have in our own discipline about what makes a great book. Up until about 50 years ago, everybody was really happy with this concept of what makes a great book, the classics, right? And Mortimer Adler was one of the people who just died recently, initiated this great books program. And for a time, everybody was really comfortable with this. Why not read this? But then there was somebody, and I'm really oversimplifying this for time, named Mary Louise Pratt, who was from Canada, and she taught in the California university system. And she says, wait a minute. There are other voices and other people. The great books are all books written by white men. What about the women? What about minorities? Don't they have a voice? And isn't it terribly arrogant to assume that all the great books have been written by white men? Well, this has caused a lot of controversy in our discipline. You probably heard some of the rumblings of that one way or the other. And the arguments range from everything where some people will say anything a minority or a woman or anybody wrote has its own voice and it's valorized by the reader, whatever the reader imposes upon that, to the other extreme that there is only there are only certain criteria for what makes great books, and a lot of this stuff just is riffraff and it doesn't qualify. So those are the two extremes. What I would like to do today, well, just tell you a little bit more. Curiously, my own discipline is the only place where this argument has arisen. You don't hear it with mathematicians or with other scientists, but you hear it a lot in literature. And then there was another problem that occurred quite later. I'm leaping over history that I could talk with you about, you know, some other time. And if you'd like, I'd be glad to, you know, after supper or so. But there was also the argument that literature is part of the humanities. And it would have a humanizing effect. So this was another one of the criteria that people used for what makes great books. It has to have some kind of a humanizing effect. And the arguments for that range all the way back to tragedy, where the audience was invested in these characters who were a little larger than life, but someone whom we could relate to. And then something awful happened. There was this fall. Something awful happened. And there was this catharsis that we could experience watching their fall and experiencing it with it, and then just being cleansed by that whole experience. So literature not only was supposed to have certain criteria as an art form, but it also was supposed to have a humanizing effect on us. And people believed that right until World War II, when some of the Allied forces marched into the Nazi camps and freed, you know, all the people who had so sadly been imprisoned, and saw that the Nazi soldiers were reading some of the great books, some of the classics. And so humanists were stunned. How could these Nazis be reading the great books and act the way they are? So anyway, that threw that theory out, pretty much. what I would like to do, and since then, the canon in American, in any kind of literature, has expanded so that a lot of times it's hard to know what really makes a great book, and then people will say, well, how dare you judge? But I think we need to have some starting point as to what really makes great literature. And so, Paul Olson, who we just met, I don't know if those of you who know him, and an old friend of mine from Augustana College named Roel Tweet, the three of us taught a course, about 5 years ago, on what's the best book we ever read. We all argued about our best book. So in order to do that, we needed to establish some criteria. So these are the criteria that we established, and you may or may not agree with them, but at least it'll give us a basis for arguing or for, you know, determining why we like what we do. And the first criteria for that is something that fires your soul. It's the wow, you've got to read this book factor. All right? So the first criteria, folks, is, get a better one here. It's got to fire your soul. Okay? The second criteria for what makes a great book is something that's beautiful. All right? And when I talk about something that's beautiful, I'm talking about something in terms of lyrical language, precision of diction, language choices, attention of description, contrast, but all of those wonderful things that you see not only in fine literature, but it pretty much translates to what you see in art and what you see in music as well. And it doesn't necessarily mean we're talking about what's beautiful. But what we're saying is the rendering is beautiful. So you can have, you know, William Faulkner can write some pretty ugly stuff about incest and misogyny, a whole variety of things, but he can write about it in a beautiful way. A stunningly beautiful way. Coetzee from South Africa in Disgrace can write about some really miserable stuff. In language, it's just lyrical. So maybe you've seen literature that isn't violent for violence sake or isn't sensational for sensational, but is dealing with some pretty awful stuff. And you think, I shouldn't be reading this, but it's just so stunning. Well, chances are, it's beautifully written. And I think my first exposure to that was when I was in high school. I come from a very conservative background, far more conservative than I would imagine anybody sitting here, which I happily left. But I can remember at the time picking up Nabokov's Lolita when I was in high school. And I found it at the top of a garbage heap, and I just picked it up and I started reading it, and I can remember two things. I knew it was beautifully written, and I knew I best not be reading this. I better not get caught reading it. Okay, so something that fires your soul, something that's beautiful. The third criteria is a central character who comes alive. And that can be a town or a person. And this is what William Styron, and that's a whole other story, how Paul got William Styron at Augustana College. But he said, you have to have a central character who comes alive. In Styron's work, Sophie's Choice, Sophie becomes a real person. You can see. In Huck Finn, you know, he becomes a real person. Jim becomes a human being. That's why that book isn't racist. I mean, you get to see how Jim feels as a human being, not as a piece of property. All right. Ahab comes alive. I'll be talking about him next week. All right, a central character that comes alive. Fourth, you've got to have a sense of morality, a drama of ethical significance. Okay? So, you know, to write a novel that centers on what color of socks a cheerleader is going to wear for the next game probably isn't going to make it as a great book. And then finally, five is something you want to return to. There's a lot of books, page turners. In fact, I just finished an Agatha Christie novel right now. It was fairly riveting until toward the end, but I would never want to read it again. But I mean, I look forward to getting in bed at night and reading this book, but I don't ever want to read it again. It doesn't have any substance to it. But I know, for me at least, every time I read Moby Dick, I see something new. Every time I read Sophie or Huck Finn, and to some extent, Barbara Kingsolver. But those are the criteria, and a lot of times, books that are really great, we struggle with. And maybe we don't like them at first. It's too hard, or they're too much trouble to read. But there's something that sticks in your mind that you remember, and for some reason, it draws you later on, you want to return to it. So those are the criteria that we have developed. And so we can kind of use them as a starting point. Anybody have anything else you want to add or challenge? Or?
Well, I'm curious of whether you're talking about novels or just books of all types. Mm-hmm. I mean, biographies, autobiographies.
Basically, I think we're talking basically fiction.
Okay.
But I think it can, I haven't read the John Adams book yet. Everything's a hot thing.
Everybody's, yes, and it's excellent.
And see, now that's not a piece of fiction, right. And you're saying this is really good. This character comes alive, it might be beautifully written, maybe it has ethical dilemmas in it.
Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah, it fires, and you think, whoa, this is a book you got to read, people are doing this, so, you know.
I'm reading Daniel Webster right now, the autobiography, and probably the best book I ever read, and I read mostly historical things, but was Undaunted Courage.
You mean,
Lewis and Clark just came alive. Yeah. In that,
okay.
You know.
So those aren't necessarily works of fiction.
No.
So, okay, you just answered your question.
Yeah.
You helped me with it.
Well, I was curious if your criteria was applying to my selections.
Well, I'm curious about that, too.
Yeah. And I think
so far it seems like it's working.
Yeah.
Well, as we talk, we may find something else we want to add or something we don't agree with. But anyway, we have a starting point. All right, let's take a look at Barbara Kingsolver's Poison with Bible. I picked this up a couple of years ago. And I thought, I've got to teach this. And the students at school really get into it. In fact, even toward the end of the quarter, especially in the springtime when they're sick of school, and some of them unfortunately are involved in pledging and don't attend class the way we would like them to, they can't put this book down. They just get hooked on it, and they pass it around to friends. So what is it about this book? So let's, for starters, let's talk a little bit about Betty Crocker in the jungle. All right, so I have some handouts for you to follow. I didn't know how many people were going to be in these classes, so I think I had 10. I figured you could share, and some of you can listen. But here's, I'm really skipping into the second chapter here. And I'll give you a little, how many of you have read this? All right. So there's a pretty good-sized group who haven't, and incidentally, this book is in the bookshop now.
Yeah.
And by all means, it would be a great book for you to read in Holden, so pick it up if you wish. And the bookshop told me that that's one of the ways, you know, they're not overcharging for the book at all, but it's one of the ways they make money here, so buy the book if you feel like it. All right. So what's the background of these people? What kind of people are, what's the story? Who's read it and talked to me? Shannon.
Shelley.
Oh, Shelley, I'm sorry.
An overzealous Baptist minister in Georgia decides he needs to go to the Congo to save the heathen. Good. Packs up his family, who is very not as zealous as he, and transports them all the way into the heart of the jungle, where we're in a, replacing a pastor who the group thinks has gone too far over the edge, actually making friends with the natives. And he comes in with fire and brimstone, trying to save their souls. And the rest of the family is trying to survive and get by and figure out life there, and hoping they can get home someday. And the pastor's relationship to his family is rigid, and not, there's no love directly. It's all a feeling of obligation and legalism.
Okay. Thank you very much. Wonderful. All right, and I think we can see what Shelley says
right away in this first paragraph.
That's good.
It's particularly about his attitude. And in fact, we can find out a whole lot about the family's attitude in the first paragraph. My theory in any great book is everything is in the first page, all the issues. I don't know why I figured out why, but Moby Dick, Huck, every issue that's in the book is on the first page. But anyway, let's see if this is true. So Leah, one of the daughters, and what's interesting, Shelley didn't tell you this, but what's interesting is that the novel is related to different voices, primarily the four daughters, who each tell their own story, and they each have their own slant on things, okay? So Leah is one of the daughters. And this is what she says. She says, and you almost have to imagine this in a deep southern Georgia accent. And I lived in Georgia for 2 years, but I'm not so sure I can. We came from Bethlehem, Georgia, bearing Betty Crocker cake mixes into the jungle. My sisters and I were all counting on having one birthday apiece during our 12-month mission. And heaven knows, our mother predicted, they won't have Betty Crocker in the jungle. Let's just stop there. We'll get to the father in the second paragraph. I'll read it one more time. We came from Bethlehem, Georgia, bearing Betty Crocker cake mixes into the jungle. My sisters and I were all counting on having one birthday apiece during our 12-month mission. And heaven knows, our mother predicted, they won't have Betty Crocker in the Congo. So what's going on, just on the very basic level here? What's just the basic storyline? They came from where? Bethlehem, Georgia. And what are they doing? Okay. And so they're going to be missionaries. What other facts do we know? They're going to have birthdays, so they're going to stay there a year.
They're going to be there 1 year.
And they're bringing in what?
Betty Crocker.
Betty Crocker. What other facts do we know?
They're sisters.
Sisters?
They'll only be there 1 year.
Okay, 1 year. All right, so we know these facts. What difference does it make?
Well,
why are you laughing? Why did you laugh two times when I read this? We came from Bethlehem, Georgia, bearing Betty Crocker cake mixes into the jungle. Why do you laugh?
Because they're trying to transport their culture strange. I mean, very exotic when compared to what they're used to.
Okay, so we think it's funny.
Taking a little piece of America and putting it in Africa.
And the little piece of America is?
Betty Crocker.
What does she stand for?
American
pie.
Pardon?
Americana style.
White woman.
White woman, the perfect American woman, right? How does Betty Crocker look? What is she typically pictured as?
She looks like Mrs. Cleaver.
Like Mrs. Cleaver. So how is she dressed to make her cakes? She's dressed, if I remember correctly, isn't she wearing heels?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the heir of Betty Crocker, and this is the ultimate perfect housewife and mother. And she wants to make sure that her daughters have a proper birthday in the Congo. Some of you are moms. You've had birthdays for kids. Those are always important days, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And don't we plan, I've been a mom five times, don't we plan special days? And a lot of times that includes a cake, right? Mm-hmm. We blow the candles out, we still have those traditions. So wasn't she being a good mom? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't this commendable? Mm-hmm. Why are we still laughing?
She feels like she's trying to make sure that her children have everything they've always had.
Yeah, she wants to have the basics in the jungle, but
she doesn't have any idea what she's getting into.
And she did it. And so we can all be really sympathetic because this guy is just really a reprehensible bigot, right? All bigots are reprehensible, but he's one of the worst you're ever going to meet in any kind of literature. And we're not up to him yet. But I want you to think, folks, about what it means to take Betty Crocker in the jungle. How many of you have traveled into different countries or spent time in different countries? What are you supposed to do when you're there?
Become part of the country.
Become part of that.
Yeah. So there's something. Heaven knows they won't have Betty Crocker in the jungle is implying what?
She's already set herself up to be better than they are.
Bingo. Hmm. Yeah. There's this, and even though the mama is trying very hard to help her daughters, and we could be really sympathetic. In fact, the more we read in here, the more sympathetic we become to her. And yet, there's one way where you can read this where there's a certain bigotry here. Heaven knows they won't have Betty Crocker in the jungle, and the implication is they're just not going to be able to be up to snuff the way I would like my daughters to celebrate their birthday. So right away, you have these issues, and certainly the more you read of Kingsolver in this, the more you see there's a whole lot of tension between, you know, the Georgia fundamentalist view of Christianity and how the people in the Belgian Congo practice religion and a variety of other things in their cultures. But anyway, right in the very first sentence, Barbara Kingsolver sets some of these things up. But why do we laugh? Or do we think it's funny to undermine other cultures? Are we all kind of bigots at heart? Well, what is it about the writing that makes us laugh?
I just think, well, how many stoves are there out in the jungle?
Yeah,
and how is she going to even do that?
It's kind of a comic relief. And as you read further, Shannon, you'll see that number one, it's too humid in the jungle to even keep these cake mixes. Yeah. They all turn out to be like rocks. And secondly, they don't have ovens. You know, there's no way to bake this stuff. All right.
Beet.
Go ahead.
I just think it's interesting because she could have opened the book on a very somber note because the book is full of a tone of tragedy.
Oh, yeah.
As well.
Okay, there's.
And yet
so, tone. Oh, good. Somebody said this. All right. So, it has a lot to do with tone. And when we're talking about tone, we're almost inevitably, folks, talking about irony. And where you have, on the basic manifest level, somebody saying one thing. But we as readers know that there's something quite different going on. And usually there's an element of humor in there. In Illinois, I tell my students the best example of irony, hopefully it will relate to them. In Illinois, we have big billboards now that says, you want to drink in Illinois while you're driving? Illinois police will show you the bars. And they have all these jail bars.
Oh.
But it's a pun. It's a play on words. We'll show you the bars. You want to drink while you're driving? We'll show you the bars. But anyway, ironically, on one level, you want to drink, we'll show you the bars. On another level, watch out. Mm-hmm. See, we will show you the bars, but not the ones you're thinking of. So that's how irony works. And in Kingsolver here, we don't know it yet when we're reading the first sentence, except we think Betty Crocker is funny. But the more you think about Betty Crocker in the jungle, the more issues arise. You have this issue of mom trying to be the good mom. And you can't condemn that. But you have the issue too of mom maybe quite not having the vision that this other culture might have something for us to entertain too. All right, so we've gotten through one sentence and we're at 5:30. Let's talk about what Shelley said in terms of the relationship with the father. And when you first read the second paragraph, you think, oh, this is kind of funny. But, and I'll read it once and maybe I'll have to read it again. But let's take a look at some of the issues that are at hand. Where we are headed, there will be no buyers and sellers at all, my father corrected. The very first thing he says, this is his first line in the book, where we are headed, there will be no buyers and sellers at all. My father corrected. His tone implied that mother failed to grasp our mission and that her concern with Betty Crocker confederated her with the coin-jingling sinners who vexed Jesus till he pitched a fit and threw them out of the church. Where we are headed, he said, to make things perfectly clear, not so much as a piggly wiggly. You know what piggly wiggly is? In the South. Evidently, Father saw this as a point in the Congo's favor. I got the most spectacular chills just from trying to imagine. Second paragraph. We're not even finished with the first page. What are the issues, folks?
Father corrects.
Father corrects. Yeah. Bingo. All right. So, all right. We'll put them in between here. Father corrects. And dovetailed with that, whom does he correct?
Mother,
because she can never what?
Catch his vision.
She doesn't.
She doesn't quite see his vision of Scripture. And fortunately, she never does.
Nobody does.
But as we read on, I mean, we're hooked. Because we feel really sorry for Georgiana and what happens. But the beauty of this book, what's so funny, is you have other voices. You have this snippy, who is it? Anybody want to talk about her? We're going to talk about her next time. But Rachel, full of malapropisms, and always she's 15 going on 16. And I think the great tragedy in her life right now is that she doesn't get a twin set of sweaters for her 16th sweetheart birthday, whatever. But she has just a ton of acid and really loathes this whole prospect. And she certainly will have her voice about Father. But anyway, so you have these issues that for starters, right away, mother is trying to have a nice birthday for these kids. She's trying as well as she can to cope with the essentials. And the very first thing Father does is correct her. And the implication is, very condescendingly, that she doesn't understand the basics of Scripture the way he sees them. So, and he says he associates something as frivolous as Betty Crocker with the money changers in the church. Now, we have more issues at hand in this very first, or this second paragraph. Is mother like the money changers in the church? No. So you get the feeling that something pretty horrible is going to happen, not only with the deprivation in the Congo, but with him in charge. All right. She wouldn't go against him, of course, but once she understood there was no turning back, our mother went to laying out in the spare bedroom all the worldly things she thought we'd need in the Congo just to scrape by. The bare minimum for my children, she'd declare under her breath. All the livelong day. In addition to the cake mixes, she piled up a dozen cans of Underwood deviled ham. I don't know if they still sell that or not.
Rachel's ivory, these are the bare essentials, the bare minimum. Rachel's ivory plastic hand mirror with powdered wig ladies on the back.
Okay, and when you learn more about Rachel, you'll see why this was one of the bare essentials, right? A stainless steel thimble, a good pair of scissors, a dozen number two pencils, a world of Band-Aids, Anacid Absorbing Junior, and a fever thermometer. So she has a variety of things for health. She has a little bit of food, and she has Rachel's mirror. Well, what happens next for those of you who've read this? They're on the plane. I'm sure this has never happened to any of you in this room, where you're allowed so much, so many pounds, and you have maybe a little bit over, huh?
All the extra clothes.
So they were way over.
Cake mixes in clothes too. I'm lucky. I should look at my own handout rather than just in the book. Okay.
So, Father, in that second paragraph, the first full paragraph on page 14, Mother tried to think of every contingency, including hunger and illness, and Father does, in general, approve of contingencies. Why would he approve of contingencies? It says here, for it was God who gave man alone the capacity of foresight. So he at least gives her credit for thinking ahead because, you know, after all, we are the select species that can think ahead. All right, we had to hang around Holden, although we wouldn't want his company. And he might take a look at some of the animals and just basic plant life. And I think he could make a fairly compelling argument that there's something about them that plans ahead, too. So she procured a good supply of antibiotic drugs from our granddad, Dr. Bud Wharton. And you learned earlier on that he's been an optician, who has senile dementia and loves to walk outdoors naked, but still can do two things perfectly, win at checkers and write out a prescription. Okay, so you have this little bit of information that, you know, it's kind of bittersweet. It's sad that he's demented enough to walk around naked and it's her father. And on the other hand, it's kind of funny that he can still write out prescriptions and play checkers. And you know, we know people like this, don't we? Yeah. So it's human. So she tells us a little bit more, and then at the bottom of the page, you hear that they were only allowed 44 pounds. And so they have to toss some of the things, and so one of the first thing that goes is Rachel's hand mirror, and here's what she says. You get a taste of Rachel right away. I reckon the lilies need Bibles, though. He's talking about lilies of the field. And his darn old latrine spade, Rachel muttered, as her beloved toiletry items got pitched out of the suitcase one by one. And Leah says, Rachel never does grasp scripture at all that well. So, but the irony is when he's talking about the lilies of the field, they neither toil nor spin. And so she's got to throw out this mirror that she enjoys for her own vanity. But she immediately has this instinct for the jugular in terms of his hypocrisy, and she says, I suppose the lilies need Bibles. and his darn old latrine spade. And it's interesting that those two are coupled together in Rachel's mind, the Bible and the latrine spade. And Rachel, and then Leah comments, Rachel never does grasp scripture that well. Well, as you read this, you'll see that Rachel is really resistant to anything her father says. And what's her philosophy, just to get people hooked on this thing? What happens when she's in a crowd, for those of you who've read it? She's read this book on how to survive. Put your elbows out and go through a crowd and let the crowd carry you, and you always stay on top.
That's how Rachel survives. And we may not like Rachel. And next time when you're here, we'll be Rachel. She has all these malapropisms. But I think Rachel's a survivor. And think about this next time when you come back. What is it about somebody who might be a survivor? Maybe isn't a kind-hearted Christian. What does that mean? And are those two not compatible in a situation of life and death?
You'd be looking out for yourself.
What does that mean?
Supposed to be.
Yeah. But anyway, talk to me a little bit about the names. Who knows these names? Rachel and Rebecca and Leah, Ruth May. Where did they come from? Okay, what's the story behind this?
Papa named them.
Pardon?
I bet Papa named them.
Oh, I bet they did. They're from this fundamentalist family. And to get the background before, he was one of these Bible thumpers that went down the Sawdust Trail in Georgia. And Georgiana fell for him because of the charisma. And I think the book tells you she didn't really have any other opportunities. Mm-hmm. So she kind of fell under his spell. What about the name? So they have Rachel's the oldest, she's 15. Who's Rachel in the Bible? Maybe I don't have to ask too many of you. Probably all know that. My students nowadays don't know these things. So Jacob's
second
one. She was the beautiful one. And Rachel have I loved. You know, Leah have I. Hey, Rachel have I loved. And you know the story where Jacob was tricked. He worked very hard. He promised to work for Laban for 7 years for Rachel. And evidently they had lots of veils over the bride after the 7 years was up, and he wound up with Leah. So he went back to Laban and he had to work 7 more years. Okay. So meanwhile, Leah has all these children who become the tribes of Israel, yes?
If you read the Red Tent, it's a bit different story.
Okay, what's the story in the Red Tent?
Oh, that he does fall in love with Rachel on sight, but she's much too young. And he's not tricked, he accepts Leah. It just depends on how
you have more than one wife.
Now, a scripture story?
Yes.
And so what you're saying is there's a whole different way of interpreting
that story.
Well, I'd be interested in rereading that.
So that Leah is his first wife and the mother of most of his children.
Okay, and so, but he willingly accepted this and was willing to work. Gee, we have a Bible in the other room. I'm not going to read that. No, really. There are a lot of ways.
These are all Bibles.
Pardon?
These are all Bibles.
Why didn't you find this while we're talking?
It's in the Genesis.
Yeah. And so well, you find this while we talk. All right, so Rachel was one of those daughters. Where did Leah come from? The other ugly daughter, supposedly, or the more convenient, or the early daughter. All right, and in the story, Leah becomes eventually the one who's the most committed to human rights and what happens in the Congo. And I don't want to tell you too much, but that's eventually what happens to her. And at first, she just adores her dad. She wants to be exactly like him. And she just hangs on him, hoping that he will approve of what she does. And does he ever approve of her?
No.
And then finally, there's an incident in the book, a couple incidents that occur, where she decides, almost out of necessity, she needs to stand on her own. And it's a life-changing experience, certainly for Leah. And as readers, we think, wow. But anyway, it's one of the things that moves her closer to the Congo and farther away from, certainly from fundamentalism, Baptist fundamentalism in America, and particularly in Georgia. All right, so we have Leah and Rachel. All right, Rachel's the eldest, and Leah is one daughter, and there's another one who is?
Ada.
Now, does that come out of scripture? Is there any Ada that anybody knows of in scripture? No. And Ada, what's their identical twins, and what's the story with Ada? Leah and Ada were identical twins.
Like a limp leg, and she doesn't really talk.
She's a handicapped child.
Like autistic kind of.
Well, we don't quite know what it is, but she is handicapped. What we do know when we read this is that she reads things in reverse letters. So there are a lot of word plays in Ada's part of this book that if you're interested in that kind of thing, or if you're a crossword puzzle player, or if you're interested in malapropisms is in another issue, but she plays on words, and what's really fascinating is it's one of the devices, the rhetorical devices that King Salver uses to undercut or to ridicule his father, because she plays on words, and I'll show you some examples of that next time. So who else is, who's the final child?
Ruth May.
And Ruth, we all know the story of Ruth in the Bible. She was faithful. I don't know about May. Ruth May. But again, she's, how old is she?
Five.
And next time we're going to talk about Jimmy Crow in the Bible, because that's what Ruth May says, that Jimmy Crow is in the Bible. My question to you is, how does Ruth May come to this conclusion? Okay, so we have a couple things to talk about next time. The tension between standing up for yourself and surviving, or being self-sacrificing, as a lot of us are taught to do. That certainly is at work in this novel. Now, I'm assuming all of you won't have time to read this novel by tomorrow, but we can certainly, what I would like to ask you, those of you who've read it, why don't you pick out your favorite passage? Something that you really love to read in that, something that just really fired you. And we'll talk about that. You know, what issues you want to talk about in that book, what makes it great. And you may not, was there anybody who wasn't really attracted to this book?
I quit reading it.
You quit reading it. And tell me when you quit reading it. We don't want to spoil it for everybody, but was it kind of after, like, about two-thirds of it?
It was actually about a third. I got him there. His just bullheadedness in terms of, how he's going to plant the crops.
Okay.
And suddenly I'm going, this guy's not going to change. This guy's an idiot. Why am I reading this?
Tell us a little bit. I don't think you'll destroy the plot. Tell us a little bit about how he planted the crops.
Yeah.
What did he decide?
Well, he wanted to plant the crops the way he knew how to plant the crops. And this old woman.
All right, the way he knew how to plant the crops, coming from the Midwest, there's a real obvious way of planting corn and soybeans and stuff.
Perfect, in straight rows.
In straight rows. This is the way it's done. Right. What was wrong about doing that in Africa?
Well, because they all washed out.
They all washed out, which might explain why they don't raise soybeans and corn right there. But also, so anyway, what happened? What was the scene? Somebody was what?
Well, of course, I quit reading about there, but
but there was this tension. Someone said, you really need to change the way you've done this, and what happens?
And he doesn't, but he might have the same damn way. That's where I quit.
Okay. All right, so there's this woman, this black, ignorant woman, who tells him, you need to, and she actually replants his plant.
She replanted it, and then he tore him up.
And went through great work of replanting his plants. He sees this, and he's going to do it his right and wrong way.
Right.
What eventually happens?
I don't know.
I have to go back and read it.
Maybe you'll want to read it. You can laugh, but it's perfectly fine in this class. In fact, it's much more interesting when we have people who don't always agree, especially if you don't agree with me. You know, I'll be talking about Moby Dick next week. I don't know if any of you will be here. They said in the bookstore, they didn't quite come out and say, that's got to be the book from hell. Who'd ever want to read that? But the implication was, Why in the world would anybody come here to Holden Village and try and persuade people that Moby Dick was a great book? Hand in glove with, I know I'm supposed to read it, but you know, I hate this book, or I never could get through it, and it has all this stuff about whales in it and water. Anyway, we're gonna talk, it's perfectly all right to disagree. Or Huck Finn, is it racist? Well, we'll talk about that. But with Kingsolver, I could see where you might have an objection. Anybody else?
I started it once, and I didn't like it at all. I got to like the third.
Okay.
It was 50 pages. Mm-hmm. And I was so frustrated with the father of these guys. And I thought I don't know if it's from my own history or whatever, but I just couldn't stand this guy. I wasn't going to read it. It was too hard. I just didn't like it.
Okay.
Which, when you were listing great books, you know, you were saying sometimes that they might be hard to read.
Yeah.
And then a friend of mine read it and said, no, you just have to
keep going.
Keep going. And I did, and I was so glad I did.
You got hooked on it.
It's one of my favorite books.
Okay. Now it's one of your favorite books.
Is it fiction or nonfiction?
Oh, it's fiction.
It's fiction.
Okay.
But Kingsolver
is a lot of real care of people.
She spent a year in Africa because her father was a missionary or a
he
health.
He wasn't a missionary.
Yeah, maybe a doctor or a health.
They were, I think it even tells me, whoop, doesn't it? That her parents were, they were social activists. They were involved in certain social causes in Africa, and she'd been wanting to write this book for a long time. And so she did live there, and she did see it. When I read this, I had read other books of Barbara Kingsolver and found them, you know, engaging, but I never realized that she could write as well as she could. And one of the things she said about this was that this was a book that has weighed on me for a long, long time, and I wanted to write it really well. Next time, I would like to talk with you a little bit more about that book and whether it really is a great book. I have some reservations about it, and I don't want to talk about it right now, but so far, one of the things that, just to conclude today, one of the things that seems to be at work in this book, where we have to laugh and we want to read it, we want to return to it probably, at least I like to. I'll show you some passages there where it's just beautifully written. These characters do come alive. There is an ethical concern. You may or may not want to return to it. One of the things, I just like to propose this, one of the things that I think makes really engaging, probably great fiction, or at least good fiction work, is how an author can use irony, where you have these depths of, and layers of meaning in a text where you could take Betty Crocker into the jungle. But in some ways that can be a really loaded statement. There's a lot of other meanings to it. And the more we talk about it, the more we can see is at work in this. All right, I think I'll let you go. And those of you who, well, you know, don't have plans for tomorrow and think you're going to find your way back, it's at 5 o'clock, right? I think tomorrow. And those of you who are not, please return your copies. Or everybody might want to just return your copies if you don't know. But I would like to use them to refer to tomorrow.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you. I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to talk tonight with at least one person about who's leaving tomorrow, about Norman McLean's A River Runs Through It and Young Men in Fire. And so we'll be doing that after supper, I don't know, in the dining room or where. But anybody who would like to join us is welcome to do that. We'll see you then.